This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. Today, we mark the centenary of the coming into effect of the truce on the 11th of July, 1921. Why did it happen then? And why had peace feelers in late 1920 failed? What motivated each side to sue for peace? What were their expectations? To address these and related questions, we're joined by John Dorney, editor of the Irish Story website and author of Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924, and that was published by New Island Books in 2013. David McCullough, broadcaster and author of a two-volume biography of Eamon de Valera, Rise, 1882 to 1932, and Rule, 1932 to 1975. And they were published by Gill Books in 2017 and 2018. Eve Morrison, author of the much anticipated Kilmichael, The Life and Afterlife of an Ambush, and that will be published later in the year by Irish Academic Press. And finally, a regular Hedge School panellist, Pádraig Óg O'Rourke, author of Truce, Murder, Myth, and the Last Days of the Irish War of Independence, published by Mercer Press back in 2016. And this Hedge School is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, John Dorney, I want to go to you just to talk to us about the failed peace feelers of late 1920. But just before I do, can I just throw out a general question, maybe to the rest of the panel, and that is, in conflict situations, are there always back channels of communication? John?
Yes, there are, Tommy. I mean, the nature of conflict, I suppose, and violent conflict, is that you're supposed to have irreconcilable differences, and that's why you're fighting. So it's difficult to justify to the people who you ask to do the fighting while you are talking to these supposedly implacable enemies at the same time as you're also killing and dying. Now, in the case of an internal conflict and insurgency, such as we had in Ireland in 1920 and 21, you also have the added thing where the government side, which is the British side in this case, doesn't recognize the insurgents in most cases as legitimate combatants, as people with the rights of belligerents, that they're rebels, murderers, terrorists, all of which terms were used in Ireland in 1919 to 21. And so the government has a hard time, at the one hand, saying that they're basically dealing with armed crime, and at the same time talking to people. So the result is it has to be done in secret. It has to be done in a deniable way. And that job fell to an unfortunate but talented man in some ways, Alfred Andy Cope in Ireland in 1920, 1921.
John, can I just hold you there for one second? I just want to bring David McCullough in there. David, with your current affairs hat on, just on that general question of back channels of, you know, secret negotiations. I mean, is that the rule then, would you say, worldwide?
It certainly seems to happen fairly regularly. And I mean, not exactly current, but we saw the same during the Troubles right the way through the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. British officials were in contact, if not directly with the IRA in the north, certainly with people who had been fellow travellers, members of the Republican movement, perhaps representatives of Sinn Féin. The Northern Ireland office had a secret premises in Belfast where they held these, a suburban house where they held these kind of back channel meetings. And partly it's to explore whether there might be a route towards peace, towards a settlement, as, you know, as John says, and also to try and get a handle on what exactly these people are looking for, what exactly the state of morale within the opposing camp is. So I think it is a tool that governments do use, but they always want to have deniability. They always want to be able to stand up in Parliament, as John Major famously did, and deny any contacts with the Republican movement, when at the time, of course, there were contacts and quite high level ones at that.
And of course, that's a very good thing. Otherwise, conflicts the world over would never be resolved.
Looking for a way through. Yeah.
Yeah. John, can I just go back to, sorry to interrupt you, David, just go back and talk to us again about the situation in 1920.
Yeah, so you have a situation where the British government has an agenda for Ireland, which is implementing the Government of Ireland Act, which will pass Parliament in the summer of 1920. That will create two Home Rule parliaments, so limited autonomy for two different parts of Ireland. And then you have the separatist republic declared in 1919. So that's the situation. One side wants complete independence for all of Ireland. The British government wants limited autonomy and partition. And, you know, that's why you have a violent conflict, basically. Now, Lloyd George is a liberal, of course. He's the prime minister, but he's in coalition with the Conservative Party, who are the majority party in the coalition. The Conservatives are close allies of the Ulster Unionists. For the most part, with some exceptions, ardent imperialists as well, so very opposed to any chink in the armour of the Empire appearing in Ireland, showing weakness in Ireland, granting independence to Ireland. And so, in April of 1920, up to that point, basically, you had an unusual situation in terms of the evolution of British government in Ireland. You had the Lord Lieutenant, Sir John French, the most important figure in the country, whereas normally it was the Chief Secretary. John French is a military man, favouring military suppression, had banned the First Dáil, had banned Sinn Féin. By April of 1920, it was already apparent this wasn't working. There was a mass hunger strike. There was a general strike called by the Labour movement. Clearly, the Sinn Féin party had a great deal of support, were determined and willing to proceed with both an insurgency, an armed insurgency, and like a civil insurgency in a sense. And so a team of new civil servants was sent over to Dublin Castle by Lloyd George, John Anderson, Mark Sturgis, and Andy Cope. And to Andy Cope fell the task of establishing clandestine contacts with, especially with the Republican leadership, but especially with Michael Collins, who had assumed this position of not in theory the head of the Republican movement or the Republican government, but very much the kind of prime mover behind the Republican movement at the time.
So there was a recognition in the castle that Collins was the key man?
It seems to be, stage. Yeah. Yes, it seems to be at this stage, even though Collins was the director of intelligence of the IRA and the minister for finance. He wasn't the head of either the government or the army in theory. But, you know, it was recognised on all sides already that Collins was probably the most important personality.
Eve, you want to come in on that?
I just wanted to add to what John Dorney was saying there, because the head of the British Civil Service, Warren Fisher, kind of organised sending over the civil servants that he's talking about. He was a lifelong home ruler. His wife was Irish. And he, from very on in the spring, he was telling Lloyd George and the rest of the cabinet that they needed to recognize Sinn Féin and to restore order and to stop the reprisals as soon as possible. So part of the reason of what happened after the summer of 1920 is because Lloyd George and the others just didn't pay attention to the advice of their own experts. So it's just, you know, so it's important not to oversimplify the British position, because there certainly were elements in among the establishment who really were arguing quite strongly for them to recognize the insurgents, or at least Sinn Féin, because the argument was as if they could, Warren Fisher thought that if you could kind of deal with the more moderate end of Sinn Féin, then it would be a means of undermining the more extreme end. And, you know, who knows? It could have, you know, it might have worked, but we'll never know now.
Well, John, maybe go back to you then. What happened then in late 1920, or what didn't happen?
Yeah, well, just one precursor is that these civil servants, as Eve has alluded to, were very strong on the idea that you have to offer more than home rule as a means of starting talks. So you have to offer dominion status, something like Canada and Australia had, which even by this time was almost independence within the British Empire. Now, in late 1920, you had several months of behind the scenes, and it's Cope left no papers, and we can't be sure exactly what passed between Cope and Collins and Griffith at this time, but certainly there was. He set up one round of indirect talks by which talks were opened indirectly via intermediaries between Arthur Griffith and Lloyd George, Arthur Griffith, the acting head of the Republic. This was temporarily scuppered by Bloody Sunday in November 1920 and the escalation of violence that followed. Interestingly, though, Lloyd George sent a message to Arthur Griffith saying, keep your head. It doesn't matter, basically, how many people are killed. That's the nature of conflict. We have to find a way out of this. In December, there's a more substantial kind of peace initiative, which is brokered by the Archbishop of Perth in Australia, Clune, whose nephew had been killed, been extrajudicially executed by the auxiliaries in Dublin Castle on the night of Bloody Sunday. But Clune mediated between Lloyd George, and again, he's escorted to Mountjoy because Griffith by this time is in jail in Mountjoy.
So, John, just go back there. Clune is a guy who was totally unconnected. He was a totally innocent victim of Bloody Sunday. Is that right?
Yeah, Connor Clune.
He's the guy who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's a huge coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know the exact kind of emotional impact this had on Archbishop Clune and whether this alone motivated him to mediate. But, I mean, it must have been on his mind, clearly, that his nephew would be killed. But, you know, the substance of the talks were that an end to violence is possible. We can talk on the basis of Dominion Home Rule, so more than Home Rule. Now, the problem was, number one, there's a lot of hardliners in Lloyd George's cabinet. So Lloyd George is a very slippery customer, and he says one thing to one side, even in his own coalition, another thing to the Irish separatists and so on, another thing probably to the civil servants. But the basis of the offer of peace is Dominion Home Rule. Now, the problem is how to stop the violence before you can get to talking. Well, Lloyd George sets out what are to Collins and Griffith, with whom he's talking indirectly, a set of unacceptable preconditions. So the IRA has to hand in their arms. So this will be familiar to them.
Decommissioning, yeah.
They have to hand in their arms. They have to surrender them to the British forces. They have to cease murderous attacks on Crown forces. That's the language that's used. But the Dáil is also not allowed to assemble in total. So anyone who's an IRA official, and this includes people like Michael Collins himself, Richard Mulcahy, wouldn't be allowed to attend the Dáil because, you know, they're wanted criminals, or the Parliament of Southern Ireland, as Lloyd George wanted to frame it. So this comes back to Collins and Griffith via Clune, and both Collins and Griffith, so they're agreed on this, say, this is unacceptable, we won't surrender. And Griffith, you know, who's identified as a moderate in hindsight because of the treaty, but he says, we will not surrender no matter what methods of frightfulness are used. And Collins says, you know, the IRA is not broken. Sends this message back to Griffith. However, I mean, or sends this message back to Lloyd George. Now, Lloyd George, again, ever the slippery customer, nevertheless proposes to his own cabinet a truce in the very last days of 1920 and to his military officials. And they reject it out of hand. So the people like Hammer Greenwood, who's by this time the Chief Secretary of Ireland, Henry Tudor, who's his chief of police, a military man though, really, and Neville Macready, who is at sometimes a conciliatory point, a conciliatory figure. He's the commander-in-chief of British forces in Ireland. But by this point, he says, no, what we have, the rebels, as he calls them, have rejected peace initiatives. We need a policy of coercion. With enough troops and with martial law, rather than kind of the halfway house, which he felt had been used up until then, we can break the rebellion, and then we can impose whatever settlement we want. And he promised success by May of 1921.
Well, it could be argued, John, therefore, that you know, that the British maybe have seen these peace overtures simply to tee up, you know, a more aggressive security policy, you know?
You know, I don't really think that they're thinking as strategically as that. I think they're kind of almost making it up as they go along. So Lloyd George wants to get out of the situation in Ireland. He wants to terminate it. The military people are saying, you know, we can't terminate it on this basis. But, you know, even the most hardline of people on the British side are also saying by this point, well, we're going to have home rule anyway. So it's quite a complicated thing. And I'm not sure the British had such a well mapped out strategy, Machiavellian strategy, as that, Tommy, in their minds.
Now, Porrig wants to come in.
Yeah, just to say that obviously the British do impose very, you know, stringent terms that really would have amounted to a surrender by the Republican forces if they agreed to them. You know, their idea was that the IRA would declare a ceasefire, but that the British wouldn't do so. And it would be kind of a unilateral, it would be the rebels asking for the troops. But one of the things, part of the blame has to lie on the Republicans and people within the Sinn Féin party as well. Because apart from the back channels between Collins and Bishop Archbishop Clune, who meet over to, you know, and then sending messages to Lloyd George, you also have at least three or four very significant but totally unofficial and maverick peace overtures made by people in Sinn Féin just completely off their own bat. One of them is by Father Michael Flanagan, who is the vice president of Sinn Féin, I think, at the time, or certainly a very senior figure. And, you know, he just announces in, you know, coming up to December of 1920 that there should be a truce and is publishing things in the paper and goes to Britain to meet Lloyd George. You also have Patrick Moylett, who is a Sinn Féin member of Galway County Council. And the Galway Council passes this peace resolution that is then sent around to other councils. Now, a lot of them, like Clare County Council, which is led, it's chaired by IRE leader Michael Brennan at the time, burned this resolution. They're so angry. And then you have a Sinn Féin TD from Wexford named Sweetman, who is in favour of republicanism, but has moral qualms about the legitimacy of the IRA's guerrilla methods. And he starts writing, you know, letters in the papers saying there needs to be a ceasefire. We need to halt these ambushes. So when Lloyd George sees, apart from Clune and the kind of official back channel, all these other unofficial ones springing up, he says that these fellows have shown us the white feather. You know, they're willing to surrender. And then he's taking more seriously the advice of his generals, who are just saying, give us another month, give us another month, and we will defeat the rebels and the problem will be solved.
Eve, you want to make a comment there?
I agree with John in terms of you shouldn't overestimate the coherency of the British side, because I mean, a part of the problem, and particularly from the separatist side, is that they were, Hammer Greenwood and Lloyd George were standing up in Parliament and lying through their teeth about the unofficial reprisals by Crown forces and the level of illegal killing that was going on. And if you look at things like Henry Wilson's diaries over the summer of 1920, which everybody should read, they're incredibly indiscreet. He was going bananas, right, over this. He was saying, now, this wasn't from a pacifist perspective. He was saying, you know, we take people out into the public square and shoot them so everybody can see. But he was saying that if you stand up and you lie about killing IRA men at night and things, but keep doing it, he was saying you're going to lose the empire. And in October, Macready and Henry Wilson, they send a kind of protest to Lloyd George outlining the situation. And they said, look, you either give us martial law or you make a deal. So, I mean, it's not like they didn't know what was going on. And the thing is, I find what John Dorney's talking about, the peace moves at the same time, is like, I just wonder what he thinks about the fact of why Lloyd George and Hammer Greenwood and things like that were then standing up and like making it very difficult to implement what they were secretly seemed to be kind of advocating.
John, you want to come back on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just the incoherence of their thinking at the time. So, you know, Lloyd George is at one point saying it's not a war, it's a police action. At the same time, he's basically turning the IRC into a military force. They're saying they're upholding the restoration of law and order in Ireland. At the same time, they're encouraging, really, Crown forces to do illegal reprisals. So, and not just killing IRA members, but also burning down towns and villages and creameries around the country. So at the same time, I mean, Lloyd George has probably internally accepted that he has to make a compromise with these people. So, you know, Lloyd George being the man that he was, being the master of kind of deceit and double talk, I don't think he's necessarily looking for a grand plan or to resolve these contradictions. I'm sure there were all these contradictions were going around in Lloyd George's head at the same time. And the goal is to get out of Ireland on terms that are acceptable, first of all, to his coalition, and secondly, to the British Empire, I would say. And he's prepared to do anything to do that. So, you know, he's prepared to try coercion. He's prepared to try reprisals. He's prepared to try martial law, but he's also prepared to try compromise.
Okay, let's just move things on a bit here. David, can I just bring you in? Because Eamon de Valera returns from the United States in December 1920. Is that a game changer? I mean, is that central to our story here today?
I think it's certainly part of it. I mean, just to pick up on something John was saying, Lloyd George said in December 1920 to Tom Jones, the Deputy Cabinet Secretary, that their policy should be to crush the murder gang, but that whenever there's any opening for peace, take it and don't be too rough on the purely political lot. So obviously that dichotomy in British policy was well captured by that remark. And that was part, that kind of fed into the return of de Valera, because de Valera went to great lengths to hide away in the bottom of a ship and get smuggled from Liverpool back to Dublin. And you know, made a lot of capital over the years of the story of his daring do and his escaping the clutches of the British who were trying to stop him from getting back to Ireland. But actually, the British cabinet had decided that they wouldn't stop him coming back to Ireland. They viewed him as a potentially a more moderate figure, somebody that they might be able to do business with. And this is why Lloyd George is saying, let's not be too rough on the political lot, i.e. De Valera, Arthur Griffith, and so on, and try and see if there's some scope for some sort of peace moves. And the fact that the Clun initiative, the peace moves that have already been discussed, were underway was part of the reason for De Valera coming back from America. He obviously sensed that there was movement happening at home and he wanted to be part of it. Also the fact that Arthur Griffith had been accidentally arrested, which left Michael Collins in charge, didn't seem to sit well with him, so he wanted to get back to take over the reins as quickly as he could.
Now, what was De Valera's view of the War of Independence as it was being prosecuted by the IRA at this time, David?
Well, he didn't really approve of guerrilla warfare. Richard Mulcahy, the chief of staff of the IRA, recalled meeting him the day after he came back from America, and he claims, now obviously Richard Mulcahy detested De Valera post Civil War, so you have to take this with a grain of salt. But he claims De Valera said this odd shooting of a policeman here and there is having a very bad effect on us from the propaganda point of view in America. What we want is one good battle about once a month with about 500 men on each side. Now that chimes with De Valera's position over the course of the next few months. So it is believable. And possibly in response, IRA GHQ produced a military assessment of the campaign early in 1921. And they said that guerrilla strokes may be laughed at as flea bites, but those of the regular army are blows in the air. And that's a very good definition of guerrilla warfare. What the guerrilla army is trying to do is stay in existence, not to get drawn into big battles that might cause casualties that it could ill afford. All the IRA needed to do was to remain in being, to remain effective, to retain the ability to attack the Crown forces and to keep the war going. The Crown forces needed to militarily destroy the IRA. And while they were engaging in guerrilla warfare, that was very difficult because there weren't enough IRA personnel in the one place to be wiped out at the same time until we get, of course, to the Customs House.
Okay, well, David, you've teed it up there nicely because I want to go to Eve and Porrick on this in terms of what actually happens then on the ground over the following 6 months. Maybe who's winning, who's losing, or maybe a better question might be who thinks they're winning and who thinks they're losing. Porrick.
Well, there's kind of, from the foot soldiers, there's a lot of optimism on both sides. And this is something we'll come back to when we discuss the announcement of the truce. It surprised a lot of people. But just someone who was talking on it with hindsight, who's in a very key position, is Major Bernard Law Montgomery. He was an intelligence officer with the 17th Infantry Brigade. So he's in Cork, he's in the thick of the fighting. And this is what he says, I think, just a few months or a year after the war ends. He writes, "My own view is that to win a war of this sort, you need to be ruthless. Oliver Cromwell or the Germans would have settled it in a very short time. Nowadays, public opinion precludes such methods. The nation would never allow it, and the politicians would lose their job if they sanctioned it. If we had gone on, we probably could have squashed the rebellion as a temporary measure, but it would have broken out again like an ulcer the moment we removed the troops. I think the rebels would probably have refused battles, hidden away their arms until we had gone, and the only way, therefore, was to give them some form of self-government." And what's actually happening on the ground, to put that in context, is the British control the towns and the cities. The IRA can launch attacks, but they can't move them out of their barracks. However, the IRA in the countryside actually have, they don't title them this, but what are essentially liberated zones. Like, there's a large part of northeast Clare where there's just no RIC barracks, there's no British Army barracks, and Sinn Féin and Dáil Courts and the IRA rule, and that wasn't unusual in large districts. So when the British did have to enter these areas, they came in very large motorised convoys. Now, the IRA could attack these and snipe them, but these weren't the classic ambushes like, you know, Kilmichael or Rinmean, where they could actually get some of their ammunition back. So the IRA are unable to attack these large convoys, but they can see them coming. The IRA in the provinces are in, if we talk about just the southern counties, are in a very strong position. But in Dublin, they're in a very weak position. the burning of the Customs House really broke the Dublin Brigade of the IRA and its ability to carry on. And when you hear, and this again, Neil Jordan's film and Michael Collins is largely responsible for this, but when you hear that the IRA only had enough ammunition to last for 2 weeks, that's in Dublin City. Down in Cork, in Clare, in the Midlands, in Connacht, the IRA were in a much stronger position and leaders felt they could carry on for months. The type of fighting that's going on, it's become more intense than the previous year. I think the majority or about half the casualties are killed in the last, you know, 6 months of the conflict, May being the bloodiest. Intelligence is very important. The IRA is more ruthless. They're executing a lot of alleged civilian spies. They're also executing female spies, which is something they hadn't done, I think, in 1920. And there's disappearances. They're hiding these bodies more commonly. And also British Army deserters who previously would have been taken prisoner and interrogated are now being shot. The British, there aren't big reprisals like you see with Cork and Balbriggan. There aren't whole towns being burnt down. But what happens is that the so-called murder gang killings, the assassination of IRA men in their home, the shooting of unarmed prisoners, that is more common. And what's happening back in Britain itself is that, you know, the public are increasingly embarrassed by the war and the scandals, and it's costing the Exchequer £20 million a year. And all their wartime allies, the Canadians, the French, the Australians, their governments are raising questions about it. So that is the situation really in the South. It's important to say that in the North, it's completely different. In the South, the Republicans enjoy a lot of popular support, except for a small loyalist population. But within Ulster and within the area that becomes Northern Ireland, the situation is totally different. You have a very large loyalist population. You have an armed loyalist militia in the UVF. You have the B Specials. You also have the IRA fighting against the Hibernians, basically John Redmond supporters, many of whom are ex-soldiers and are armed. And the IRA are very weak in those areas. But overall, nationally, when they do manage to get a truce in July of 1920, it's a big moral victory for the IRA. They haven't driven the British out. They haven't won this massive national victory on the battlefield or struck a decisive blow. But the fact that in November 1920, they were being referred to as a murder gang. And by July of 1921, even in some British documents, they're referred to as the Irish Army. That was a huge propaganda victory for them.
Now, John, can I bring you in just to look at this from the British side? In other words, look at the first 6 months of 1921. From what you said earlier, if I heard you right, basically the failed peace overtures of December 1920, if you like, gave the green light to a more aggressive policy. But what was the self-analysis of that policy as it played out, you know, over the next 6 months on the military side?
Yeah, well, you're right, Tommy. I mean, basically, yeah, the military people, especially MacCready and Wilson, urged martial law rather than a police action. So it's an interesting distinction. So in 1920, you have the high point, as Padraig mentioned, of, you know, the black and tans and the auxiliaries reprisals. So kind of illegal reprisals by so-called police. Now, what you see in early 1921 is something different in the sense that martial law is declared over most of Munster, extended eventually to all of Munster, which means, you know, the military are in charge, the military can carry out executions, arrests and so on like that, which is not the case, for example, in Dublin. They still have to do court martials. They can't just intern people. And the plan is that this will be successful by May of 1921. Now, even in May, you know, the idea is that they're going to squash the rebellion by the time elections are held for the Home Rule parliaments in North and South in May of 1921. And even MacCready, up to May, is talking quite optimistically about this, that with enough troops, with extra battalions he wants, with large drives across the countryside, widespread internment, he can squash the rebellion with executions as well. And after May, MacCready starts to say something different. He starts to say, you know, it's not working. Is it the level of coercion that we're going to need here is something of the order of what we did in South Africa in the Boer War. And this is very extreme, you know, option within the United Kingdom, because what they did in South Africa was lock up the entire Afrikaner or Boer population, including the women and children, many of whom died in what were known as concentration camps, you know, have executions around the clock, seize all transport and so on, declare martial law over the whole country. So what MacCready starts to tell Lloyd George by June is something very different from what he's seeing. Even like a month or two earlier, he's starting to say, this is not winnable on terms that are acceptable to the British public, and which would produce an acceptable political outcome.
So John, what you're saying then that some cracks are beginning to appear on the British side, you know, internally, right, in how the war should be prosecuted. David, can I bring you in on the other side, on the Sinn Féin, on the IRA side? What sort of divisions are beginning to emerge here? I'm thinking in particular of, say, difficulties between Cathal Brua and Michael Collins. And I might add on a question to that. I mean, is it the case that these are personal animosities that later became political, or were they political differences that became personal, or both?
I think the disagreements between Brua and Collins were personal at the beginning, and they later obviously had an impact on the division over the treaty. The problem really with between Brua and Collins was that Collins was Brua's colleague. They were both ministers, Minister for Finance and Minister for Defence. But he was also Brua's subordinate, because Brua, as Minister for Defence, in theory at least, was in charge of the IRA. And Collins, of course, was Director of Intelligence on the GHQ staff. So that was an awkwardness. The very day that De Valera arrived back in Dublin from America, he met Brua, and Brua started complaining about Collins and the way he conducted himself. And De Valera didn't take it too seriously at the time, but it quickly became obvious that the two men were just clashing off each other. And they had been allies back in previous days. At the 1917 Sinn Féin Ardèche, there was two competing schemes for party organisation, one designed by De Valera, which was rather convoluted, and the other designed by Brua. And the only person who supported Brua was Michael Collins. So they had actually been reasonably close allies at one stage. But by this time, there was a level of animosity between them. Brua kept writing complaining letters to Collins. Collins showed some of these letters to De Valera and said, this is not gentlemanly, and most of all, it is not organisation. Brua wasn't efficient enough for Collins. Now, De Valera's approach to this was he felt he was the president. He had to be even-handed in this row. And he couldn't support one of them over the other. And that, I think, caused Collins a considerable amount of upset. He felt that De Valera should have supported him. And then the row between Collins and Brua eventually blew up in a case over some missing money from that was supposed to be used to buy guns in Glasgow. And Brua was demanding a proper accounting for this. And this seems a little bit unfair, because you're talking about the illegal purchase of badly needed weaponry. It was all cloak and dagger, and you couldn't really expect of exacting accounting standards of an operation like that. But of course, the other side of that is that Collins, as Minister for Finance, insisted on exactly that when he was in charge of spending. So there was a clash between them. Collins was very upset at basically being accused by Brua of misappropriating money. It all came to a head. De Valera had to smooth it over. But involved in that was, it wasn't just Collins that was involved in a row with Brua, it was also Richard Mulcahy, the Chief of Staff. And it got to the extent that during the truce period, Brua actually sacked Richard Mulcahy from his post because he had written a rather insubordinate letter to Brua. And basically the GHQ staff held Brua in something close to contempt. They didn't regard him as being particularly efficient or anything like that. And they felt that he was trying to interfere in their work, which had been conducted relatively well over the course of the War of Independence. So there were issues of civilian control of the military involved as well. And the problem for De Valera was that he needed the army to be run efficiently. He couldn't afford to lose his chief of staff when the fighting might resume at any minute. But he also needed to keep Brua on side, because Brua, of course, was one of the leading intransigent Republicans. And De Valera's entire strategy during this period was to try and keep the movement united, to find a compromise that could bring everybody along. So these personal animosities are impacting on political divisions and vice versa. So it's potentially a very dangerous situation. De Valera recognises that, and he tries to keep everybody working in harness, not always successfully.
Now, Eve, are there similar divisions on the ground? Maybe Pori could come into this as well, you know, amongst the rank and file of the IRA.
Yeah, of course there is. I mean, that's kind of a normal part of business. I mean, one of the things that's happened, I mean, I just want to say Porg knows I don't agree with them on this. I don't think the IRA in the South was quite as strong as he's saying. I certainly think that the period of there was a drop off in major confrontations between the IRA and the British Army, certainly in Cork after kind of by the spring. And what they start to be able to do is, you know, it's more about sniping and sabotage. And I mean, as Porg says, no, I don't know that much about Clare. Maybe Clare was different, but like on the ground. So you have to remember that, you know, that I mean, it's very easy for us to look back with kind of hindsight and in our heads make things look more coherent and exaggerate the extent of how much people actually knew at the time and how they made the decisions, you know. So there's a brilliant letter from Michael Collins, who visited Cork just after the truce, and he's talking about how badly the British Army are behaving, like they, you know, because they were excluded from the negotiations. They're humiliated. They're furious at the idea that they have to deal with the insurgents as equals. And so Tom Barry is appointed as a liaison officer, and he almost immediately falls out with the officers on the ground. Now, and to be honest with you, I don't think that was Barry's fault, because they were being very, you know, the army were being quite aggressive as well. Although at the same time, he, you know, Tom Barry was very much his own man, and he wasn't very good at listening to his superiors if he didn't agree with what they were saying. And so both Liam Lynch and Richard Mulcahy start to have real problems with him. He keeps going over their head. He keeps, you know, he contradicts their orders. He does all sorts of things. So you're certainly starting to get a lot of those tensions on the ground, and the tensions that will really come to the fore during the Civil War between Lynch and Barry start then during the truce.
Now, before we move on to the truce itself, David, I just want to go back to you, because mention has been made of the attack on the Custom House, and I'm aware we've had a head school dedicated to that issue, so I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but Porrick has referred to it as a military disaster for the IRA. Now, this was Deb's baby, David, but wasn't Deb right, though, in that because it was a propaganda success, it had achieved its purpose?
Yes and no. You're right to say it was a propaganda success, which is what it was designed to do. It was on the front pages of newspapers all around the world. And Deb's point was, it was a reasonable one, that, you know, small-scale ambushes, while they might be effective from a guerrilla point of view, they weren't effective in the propaganda war. And the War of Independence very much was a propaganda war. Mention has been made already of the pressure on Britain from its wartime allies disapproving of what was going on. So De Valera's idea was, you know, big operations, particularly big operations in Dublin, would get that international attention focused on the Irish situation and, you know, bring international pressure to bear. So from that point of view, the Customs House was a success. The problem was five IRA volunteers killed, around 100 arrested and taken out of circulation. Now, those sort of numbers, you couldn't score too many victories like that without finding yourself in very serious difficulty. The IRA was short of active, experienced volunteers. It was short of weaponry and ammunition, as has been mentioned as well. So a defeat like that, or the scale of capture like that, is obviously going to be a problem. And it did impact on the Dublin Brigade's activities over the following weeks. So I think it was a problem. I mean, De Valera's argument when he came home the first time he spoke to the Dáil, he suggested that what was needed was to try and make things look as if they were continuing at the same pace, but to slacken off their operations a bit to try and avoid reprisals by British forces. And he was prompted by understandable humanitarian motives. He didn't want civilians to be impacted as much as they were, because partly for humanitarian reasons, partly because he thought it might reduce support for the independence movement among the people. The problem was, of course, the most effective propaganda weapon in the Irish arsenal was precisely the impact of reprisals on innocent civilians. So it was actually one of the main aims of guerrilla warfare is to drive the government forces into overreacting, which will lead to bad publicity, which will put pressure on them to reach a settlement. So that was exactly what was happening. So De Valera was right in some aspects of his argument about propaganda, but he was absolutely wrong in propaganda terms in wanting to reduce reprisals on the civilian populations.
But David, could it be said that the burning of the Custom House, you know, brought the British to the negotiating table? Or is that
it has been said. It frequently is said. It's mainly by supporters, political supporters of De Valera. I think that's overrated. The argument is that it was kind of like the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War, which was militarily disaster for the Viet Cong because so many were killed and arrested, but it was a propaganda coup because it showed the Americans that they were capable of launching large scale operations in American held territory. I think that argument is overblown. I think the peace moves were underway already. I think the British were moving towards a situation where they would sue for peace once Northern Ireland had been safely established. So I don't really think it had much of an impact on the British position.
John Darney, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, just a quick comment on the Customs House from a British point of view. So as I said, you have different factions on the British side. You have the civil servants in particular are real peaceniks. So the likes of Cope, who was meeting Collins, it seems, on Abbey Street throughout. We have a number of statements in the Bureau of Military History to this effect alone, by the way, not meeting with Brewer. So that's kind of backs up, you know, the discord between Brewer and Collins. But you also have Lord Derby, who's a conservative politician who's brought over again, facilitated by the civil service, but with the full knowledge of Lloyd George, to meet Eamon de Valera in April. So just before the Customs House. So from the point of view of those people, the peaceniks, if you like, the Customs House is actually a setback. So Mark Sturgis, who's one of these people, one of the senior civil servants, writes, how can this make peace anything but more difficult? I thought we were just about to have a breakthrough, you know. So when we talk about this as a war, as a military conflict, you know, that's only half the story. So from the point of view, again, of the peaceniks, now not of the hardliners, what's happening is we already have mapped out where we're going to go. We're going to have talks about Dominion Home Rule, and that's how we'll resolve it, plus partition. And all of the killing and the fighting, from their point of view, is just dragging it out unnecessarily. Now, the problem with that, from our point of view in hindsight, is that there is another faction on the British side, particularly Hammer Greenwood, MacCready for a period of time, certainly Henry Wilson, who's the chief of all Imperial forces, who say we must break the rebellion before we talk. And that's probably what drags it out as long as it does. It could have been settled a lot quicker, probably.
Tell me, John, who in the Heliot Hunt asks for the truce, or, you know, asks for negotiations? Who makes the first move?
Well, you know, because contacts are going on all the time, it's not so simple as, you know, someone out of the blue, like, you know, is presented in, for example, the Michael Collins movie, asked for a truce. But the sequence of events is, you know, De Valera meets with Lord Derby in April, and he says, yes, if he's prepared to talk on the basis of Dominion Home Rule, not a republic, but there has to be a truce first. And so there's no truce for a while. The conflict goes on for 2 more months. The Northern Ireland Parliament is opened, as David has alluded to, in June of 1921. And that means that there's no question now of coercing Ulster, as the Conservatives put it. There's no question of forcing Ulster to come into a Dublin Parliament, which is as far back as 1912 is the sticking point. So then the thing becomes, are you prepared to talk with the Republicans in the South, the self-declared Irish Republic? The King's speech on June 22nd, for my money, has been overrated. It's a piece of choreography rather than a breakthrough, but it's a signal that they're willing to talk. And 2 days after that, Lloyd George, to answer your question finally, Tommy, formally sends an invitation to De Valera, who is president again of the Republic, to talk. And De Valera says, yes, but there must first of all be a formal truce. And the British have, first of all, hope that there will just be a slackening off and an informal truce. And De Valera says, no, there has to be a formal cessation of hostilities so that we can talk, because otherwise it wouldn't hold. And, you know, Lloyd George is the one in the end who asked for the truce.
Okay, so, I mean, you know, that's significant, right? I mean, they're the ones suing for peace, if you like. Right now, Pádraig, a truce, the guts of the whole thing was agreed by, say, the 8th of July, right? But it's due to come into effect 3 days later. This turned out to be a very dangerous period, however. Just fill us in on what happens before the truce comes into effect 3 days later.
There's a very logical reason for having that delay. If you look, it was based actually, and the British record said this at the time, it was based on the armistice that had ended the fighting in Europe in the First World War. That basically the armistice was agreed at 5 a.m. on the morning of, you know, the 11th of November 1918, but it did not take effect until 11 a.m. And the reason for that six-hour gap was that both sides could send out word to their troops that the fighting has to stop at 11. And what happens is, even in some cases where those troops know that the conflict is ending at 11, the fighting continues right up until the last minute, the last second. There's actually a very interesting sound recording in the Imperial War Museum, which shows that the most artillery fired on that day was actually fired in the final minutes of war, kind of getting in a parting shot. So in Ireland, the truce is agreed at the final details really are put in place at 8 p.m. on the 8th of July. But really, news of it has started to filter out from about 6 p.m. And it's going to come into effect at 12 noon on Monday, the 11th of July, 1921. And in that time period, 61 people are killed. 61 wow. people are killed throughout Ireland. Now, to put that in context, most of those killings happen in the south, or certainly most of them happen outside of Belfast. To give you the national figure, you're talking about 12 British soldiers killed, 4 RIC constables, or including black and tans, 8 Republican combatants, 7 IRA volunteers, and 1 Cumann na mBan woman, incidentally, the only Cumann na mBan woman killed on active duty in the conflict. 6 civilian spies were shot by the IRA. 9 civilians were killed outside of Belfast in what might be termed by the military today collateral damage. 7 of those 9 killed by the British forces. But remember, as I said, 6 civilians also shot by the IRA as spies. Looking at Belfast, which I know we'll come back to in more detail, it was known as Belfast Bloody Sunday, and 22 people were killed there in 24 hours of rioting. 1 RIC constable, which was a known goal for the IRA because he had actually been giving them intelligence, 20 civilians and 1 IRA volunteer. But there's one big myth that rises up around this, and it's from anti-Republican propaganda at the time by the British. It's the British saying that we took our gloves off and we wanted peace immediately, and the IRA kept killing. And here's a quote from General Neville Macready, who was the commander of the British forces, who goes to the Mansion House to sign the truce. And he says, the truce will begin at 12 noon on the 11th of July, 1921, until which time the British troops, while taking no risks, abstained as far as possible from unnecessary activity against the rebels, who, far from intimating such chivalrous forbearance, continued their campaign of outrage and assassination until the clock struck 12 on the 11th of July. Now, that is not true. The IRA cancelled large-scale attacks, including a spectacular in Dublin they had planned, which was nicknamed the Big Shoot-Up. You're talking about, you know, a number of British soldiers who were held at the time, including a major who was being held in Kerry. 8 British soldiers were freed rather than being executed. And if you look at the breakdown of the killings nationally, 51% were by the IRA or nationalists in Belfast. 46% were either by the British forces or loyalists, and 4% were accidental. So the killings there, in terms of those who support some level of independence and those support the crown, are almost even 51%, 46%. And this continues on in anti-Republican propaganda on the Free State side. You know, Piers Beasley, in his biography of Michael Collins, 1926, says a great many 11th hour warriors in comparatively peaceful parts of the country hastened to make up arrears by firing shots at the last moment, and there were attacks on the English forces up to within a few minutes of the troops. And really, he's aiming that at, you know, people who take the anti-treaty side in Kerry and other counties during the Civil War. And one example of this, like, these stories aren't just propaganda from the time, they often live on. And it's easy sometimes for people to pick them up by mistake and believe them. But a classic example of this is, you know, often these stories are repeated by newspaper columnists, in modern newspapers. An example of this would be the murder of RIC Constable Alfred Needham on his wedding day. The story is that he's getting married in Ennis, The truce has just been announced. And as he's leaving the church, the IRA run up and shoot him dead in front of his bride and the wedding party. And that appeared in Richard Abbott's book, Police Casualties in Ireland in 2000. Kevin Myers had it in an article marking the 90th anniversary of the truce in the Irish Independent, which is the best-selling newspaper in Ireland. There was a television documentary it featured in 2013. And even a history book I bought the other day, just published 2021, it still has it. Now, that story, yes, Nita was shot. He was a black and tan. He was standing in the street in Ennis. There was no wedding. He wasn't engaged, let alone married. The story is a fabrication that began on the internet in the year 2000. But despite being debunked years ago, it's still on the British government's police memorial roll of honour website. And just somebody invented this around the year 2000. There's no record of it before that. So there's a lot of stories like that out there that are still being picked up in the media. And sometimes it doesn't matter how thoroughly you debunk or disprove a piece of propaganda, it keeps appearing in the press, in the media, in academic and popular histories. And it's like whack-a-mole trying to stop these stories.
Eve, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, Padraig, that cuts both ways, I have to say, in terms of stories that have no evidential basis that people keep repeating over and over again. And some of them are on a lot bigger issues than the one that you've just discussed. Not that there's anything wrong with pointing out the mistake at all. I'm not saying that.
Eve, actually, now that you're speaking there, how did news of the truce spread to the combatants on the ground?
Well, the thing is, I think, they had quite a good communication system going that they ran through railwaymen and things like that and through the post offices. But, initially, a lot of people got their news from newspapers. You know, not so much the guys on the run, but certainly the brigade and the battalion staff and things like that. And then it would have filtered out through dispatches and messages and things like that. But I think initially a lot of what they knew came from the press. And actually, one of the things you have to be careful with, for instance, now that we're talking about newspapers, with the brigade activity files, there's a lot of those activities. If you check it, you could see that the guys, this when they were compiled in the 1930s, they used newspapers as well. You know, so at the time on the ground, you know, it's I think it's kind of hard to determine how much local companies and things actually knew what was going on, but I suspect some of the information filtered in afterwards, and sometimes they didn't actually find out about lots of incidents or things that were happening until much later, and then they integrate them into their accounts. It's not that they're making things up or anything, it's just kind of the way memory works.
And were they taken by surprise, Eve?
Well, I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of them were relieved too. I mean, I think, I suppose part of the problem I have with some of the things that Parg was saying is that if Cork was really that prepared to fight on, it's very hard to explain what happened in the Civil War, because they crumbled, very quickly. Some of the most extensive peace moves throughout the whole Civil War happened from Cork. Key members of the First Southern Division resigned from the IRA executive because they were going to try and prevent the elections. So, you know, and so the thing is, I'm not sure. So I guess my point is that it's not so much how many bullets they had. It was kind of psychological and how tired they were, precisely because they had borne the brunt of a lot of the fighting, and they were and a lot of them were quite exhausted. You have to remember Clonmult in February had wiped out a whole column in East Cork. And it's very hard to recover from things like that.
Now, on the other hand, though, Eva, this is based on the previous head school we had, say, on Mayo. Other countries like Mayo are on the up. In other words, they're only beginning to get active. So they have momentum before the truce, whereas Cork has been the cockpit of the struggle, as you say. And, you know, I think it's clear that there's a certain war weariness on the ground. Padraig, can I bring you in on just on the post-truce situation? To what extent was the truce observed or not observed, as the case may be?
Well, word of the truce was actually, it would surprise us how slow it took in getting out. For example, you had a British unit in Cork who only got news of the truce by carrier pigeon, about 20 hours before it was to take effect. Often it was word of mouth. Quite often people didn't believe it. A lot of the IRA guys, now again, we're going on memoirs, and as Eve has mentioned, like often memoirs are very problematic, Tom Barry and others. But, a lot of guys learned from it from, the newspapers. Some IRA units only heard of the truce a few hours before it came into effect on that morning. And then you're asking me, Tommy, what happened?
Was it observed?
Was it observed? Well, I mean, the fact that I think there was only one ambush that occurred after the truce in the south, and basically it happened, we're stuck in Cork, where near Macroom a British unit drove into an IRA ambush, and the IRA, they immediately stopped and surrendered hardly after a shot was fired, and they said to the IRA, "What the hell are you doing? There's a truce on it." What? And they, I think, took their lorry and let them off. But I mean, the fact that the IRA were able to get their units, obviously the British Army regular discipline apart from reprisals should be much stronger. But yeah, it was observed in terms of stopping the fighting at 12 noon in the south. In the north, it was only a pause, and the fighting and the killing continued there.
Yeah, just John, can I bring you in on that? Like, no truce in the north, then, I take it.
Well, it's very interesting, Tommy. Like, there's a very interesting thing happens to the IRA, post-truce, in this period between the truce and the treaty, which is the IRA is basically recognized, not in so many words, but effectively, like, there's liaison officers established in each area. Eve has already mentioned Tom Barry, who is by this stage an infamous figure for the British because of his role in Kilmichael, is a liaison officer. That means he has to meet with the British command in Cork, and he has to talk to them about the observance of the truce. Now, in the north, yes, communal violence continues, but like it's not the case that it continues. Like Roger McCorley, for example, who was an IRA commander in Belfast, has a famous quote saying the truce lasted 6 hours only in Belfast. That's not quite the case, really, because immediately after the truce, there is a liaison officer established in Belfast, and he's a man by the name of Owen O'Duffy, who by this time is an IRA GHQ staff from County Monaghan, of course. And O'Duffy liaises with the British military, and the peace is more or less, restored in Belfast after the events of Belfast Bloody Sunday, when dozens of people were killed in the days afterwards. There's a flare-up again in the north in November of that year after executive powers transferred to the new Northern Ireland government. And that's, of course, no coincidence. Also, the specialists, the Ulster Special Constabulary, are remobilized. And so sectarian violence has another flare-up in November, but it's kind of cyclical. For the most part, there's an uneasy peace really throughout most of Ireland. And what you find actually, Tommy, is it's not so much the first part of the truce, which is from truce to treaty. It's the period after the treaty, and not, I'm talking about before the Civil War now, which is much more violent after British forces have just started departing. You get an awful lot more kind of reprisal killings, revenge killings in this period after the treaty, which is also a truce period, than you do like immediately afterwards. But what you do have as well is an extraordinary situation where you have mass IRA rallies, big parades, big training camps out in the open during the truce, which technically was a violation of its terms. But it's really an extraordinary thing. And the British military are most bitter about this in their memoirs, about how could this be tolerated, that the rebels were allowed to arm and parade and drill openly throughout the country.
Okay, I want to move things on and go to you, David, because the truce came into effect on the 11th of July. And the following day, Eamon de Valera and Arthur Griffith take the boat over to London to negotiate with Lloyd George. Now, what happens in those discussions with Lloyd George in July 1921? Briefly, David.
Well, Lloyd George was a master negotiator. He negotiated the Versailles Treaty. He, John Maynard Keynes, the economist who observed him there, said he had 6 or 7 senses that other men didn't have. He was brilliant at reading body language, brilliant at bending people to his will. And he tried to do that with De Valera. And he famously, in the cabinet room in 10 Downing Street, pointed out the chairs around the table, saying, "This is where the leaders of the Dominions meet. Here sits South Africa, here sits Canada, here sits Australia." And he came to the last chair and he didn't say who would sit there, hoping that De Valera would inquire, and then he'd be able to say, "This is the seat for you once you join the club." But De Valera was wise to him and studiously ignored the question left hanging in the air. So eventually Lord George had to say it himself. So that little trick didn't work. And Lord George ended his first day talking to De Valera absolutely exhausted, white in the face, according to his staff. He just completely drained by the difficulty of dealing with Eamon De Valera and his own unique verbal gymnastics, which he said Lord George complained that he kept going back to the time of Cromwell. And anytime Lord George tried to move him on to the modern day, De Valera was back to Cromwell again very quickly. So that aside, what Lloyd George offered De Valera was dominion status for Ireland, power over taxation, justice, home defence, policing, and so on, with all the autonomy of the self-governing dominions. But there were certain conditions about the Royal Navy control of Irish waters, limits on the size of an Irish army, British recruitment to continue, and so on. So this was an offer that he gave to De Valera. De Valera discussed it with the delegation, who included Cathal Brugh and Austin Stack, and they completely rejected it. They said they couldn't possibly bring it home. It would be treason to the Republic if they did so. But there's another reaction that's interesting. Eve earlier on mentioned Sir Henry Wilson, and in his diary, Wilson said that this offer was an abject surrender to murderers. It gives complete independence under the guise of Dominion Home Rule. In short, Ireland is gone. So there you have the two very different views of what was on offer. De Valera brought the document back home, discussed it with the cabinet, and decided that it couldn't be accepted, but did agree to continue talks with Lloyd George, did agree that there was a basis for sending a delegation to London. There was a lot of tic-tacking over the course of the summer. At various stages, it looked like the talks would break down, but eventually Lloyd George broke the deadlock by just sending another message to De Valera saying, inviting him to send a delegation to discuss how the relationship with between Ireland and the British Commonwealth could be arranged in future. And that's the process that led to the treaty talks.
Now, David, in your assessment, like, we're looking at Lloyd George, right? Premier Division, international negotiator. How would you rate Dev's performance against Lloyd George? And this is leading on to my follow-up question is, you know, why wasn't he on the treaty delegation? But just talk about, how did he do against Lloyd George, in your estimation?
Well, he didn't get anywhere. He didn't get anywhere.
Not
he didn't
well,
get what he wanted.
Okay.
So from that point of view, I think he realised that what was on offer from Lloyd George would not satisfy a significant minority within the Republican movement and within his own cabinet. You know, he got nowhere on his starting point was that he would accept Dominion status for a united Ireland without the preconditions that Lloyd George is trying to impose. But if Ireland wasn't united, then it would have to be an independent republic. And he eventually came up with the idea of external association to try and square that particular circle. But I think De Valera didn't do as well as he would have wished in his negotiations with Lloyd George. And that in part, I think, explains why he wasn't on the delegation. And to move on to that aspect of it.
David, before you move on to that, just clarify one thing.
Sure.
Now, at what stage did the British recognise the De Valera and the delegation as speaking on behalf of the whole island, right? Because they made that concession at one stage, did they not?
The initial invitation had been to De Valera and James Craig. Craig as Prime Minister of the newly established Northern Ireland, and De Valera as the spokesman for a majority in the rest of Ireland. So they never really saw him as representing Northern Ireland. They reviewed the Northern Ireland question as settled, as has been mentioned before. Coercion of Ulster was no longer an issue. Now, Lord George himself didn't really give a monkey's, I don't think, about Ulster or Northern Ireland, as it could more properly be called. If there was a united Ireland, it wouldn't have bothered him in the least. But what he wanted above all else was he wanted a solution. He wanted to resolve the Irish problem, to get it off his desk, to get it out of his hair. He wasn't particularly bothered about how he'd go about achieving that. it was all a question of politics. But because he was the prime minister of a coalition which was overwhelmingly dominated by the Conservative Party, he had to take that opinion into account. He did at a later stage try and put pressure on James Craig to play nice with Sinn Féin. But James Craig was utterly unmoved. He said at one stage that he was going to sit on Ulster like a rock, and that's what he did. And at one point, Lloyd George went to Craig and he said he was in a terrible fix and he might have to resign. It was a terrible situation altogether. And Craig just looked at him and said, yes, it's remarkable how many people's political careers have been ended by the Irish question, and left it at that. So obviously Lloyd George is not going to get any help from James Craig.
Pádraig, what happens to the IRA on the ground post-truce?
Well, you have what's called the rise of the truce allure. Basically, some people who had done very little or nothing in the War of Independence suddenly go out and go to a tailor and get an IRA uniform made up and swan around in it. I think it's what's called stolen valor in the US at the moment, people claiming to have fought in wars they had nothing to do with. You had a lack of discipline. Obviously, there's guys who've been through, and all sorts of people who've been through very stressful situations, PTSD, a lot of drinking, maybe not commandeered to the same extent that it would have been stolen by Tans and so on, because again, these were locals in the area. But you had some quite unusual things like Ignatius O'Neill, who for the very beginning of the War of Independence had been a ferocious IRA leader in Clare, fell out with the Mid-Clare Brigade's leadership, the Barrett brothers, and basically from September 1920 played no further part in the war. But he next turns up when he's drinking with notorious British Army and Auxiliary Intelligence officers in Galway City. And this was really frowned on by the local IRA, who were going, well, what happened? You know, look what they did to the Lochnan brothers, Father Griffin, etc. Generally, training in the IRA improves. They're able to hold very large camps, train large bodies of men, but their intelligence suffers. Because the British know now who the IRA leaders are. Like, famously, coming back to Tom Barry, Major Percival had actually held him up at a roadblock, interviewed him, didn't realise he was a rebel and let him go. But as Eve mentioned, Tom Barry is now a liaison officer with the British. So they know who these IRA leaders like Tom Barry and Owen O'Duffy are. You also get a rise in agrarianism. You know, there had been in the conflict, the shooting of alleged civilian spies and putting labels on them, spies and informers, beware. What you see increasingly is people being shot and the label being put on them, spies and grabbers, beware. Spies and robbers, beware. And sometimes this is IRA volunteers, and sometimes it is just local people taking advantage of the anarchy to settle old scores. You also have bank robberies by some IRA volunteers. One of them, I think my favourite one, is Sean Liddy, an IRA officer in West Clare. Coincidentally, he goes pro-treaty afterwards, and the Garda's Liddy Medal is named in his honour. So someone should tell Drew Harris that there's a Garda Medal named after a bank robber. There are low-level killings continuing. Like the first, in Cork, the first two killings that occur specifically after the truce, I've included them in my 61 figure, but they're Begley and Nolan. These are two alleged spies who were picked up by the IRA in the hours before the truce. They're held for a day or two, executed, secretly disappeared. Their bodies are never recovered. You also have people like Sergeant Rue, who was a notorious member of the Royal Scots, who the IRA found drinking in Ennis and basically took him down an alleyway and I think kicked him to death or close to death before shooting him. And in the meantime, of course, the war continues in the north. So there is some breakdown in discipline. There is some degree of score settling, but overall, in terms of killing, there's very little. Usually, it has to be said, when there is some incident, quite often it's the IRA rather than the British forces who are responsible. But in the north, again, it's a very different situation.
Now, John Dorney, was a resumption of hostilities a realistic option on the IRA side?
I'm not sure if it was a realistic tactical option in the sense that, you know, if they pushed it to a military conclusion, they would eventually have lost in a military sense. But was the IRA capable of resuming war? Yes, it was. Like, we have a British Army report from late 1921. And what that says is, in a kind of a very self-justifying way, which is typical of the British military reports, it says that the IRA was beaten at the time of the truce, but now to quote, it's a much more formidable organization. And they talk about rearming. So they've managed to import quite substantial amounts of arms from America, the Thompson submachine gun, from Italy, I think, which was imported down in Waterford. And, you know, there had been big training camps. They had a lot more recruits and so on. The British military was saying, if hostilities recommence, we're dealing with a much more, much larger, much better armed organization, one that's had time to reorganize itself, and it will be difficult. And we're going to have to do things like mentioned earlier, like quite drastic measures, drives, what they called. So this means a drive across the countryside, mass internment of all the young men. You know, they're on both sides, particularly when the talks are quite precarious, which is in about November, early December. There's talk on both sides that, yes, there's a significant possibility of a return to war. For example, Richard Mulcahy visits Sean McKeown in the North Midlands, and also Kevin Monaghan visits these various IRA training camps that are openly going on. And he gets asked by the IRA officers there, you know, are we going to have to return to war? And Mulcahy says, I don't know. It's possible. So, you know, a return to war is certainly possible, yes. Would the IRA have won? Ultimately, no. Would it have mattered? Possibly not, because this is a political conflict, really, rather than a military conflict.
Well, okay, of course, we're going to have several more head schools on the treaty split and on the Civil War. Just before we finish up, Padraig, can I come back to you? Tell us, who was the last person killed in the War of Independence?
Well, it was a woman named Hannah Carey. It's funny, there's a number of contenders for this, and it can be very difficult to figure out, because often you get people shot who die later, and some of them die well over a year and a day later. But it's often been put forward that Alexander Clark, a relatively inoffensive old RIC constable who was shot in Skibbereen, was the last person killed. He wasn't even the last RIC constable killed. That was Sergeant James King up in Castlereagh, who was shot at about 10 a.m. But the very last person killed was Hannah Carey. She was a 48-year-old Catholic waitress in the Imperial Hotel in Killarney. And at a quarter to 12, IRA volunteers in Killarney, I don't even think they were Kerry men, actually. I think they were Cork guys who crossed the border to have a few drinks and celebrate the truce. They shot dead Sergeant Charles Mears, who was a member of the Royal Fusiliers. And a few minutes later, the British forces left their barracks in reaction to this. And RIC lorry of Crossley Tender lorry, full of black and tans and RIC men, raced around the town firing shots. And at 11:50 a.m., they actually shot dead Hannah Carey, who was outside the Imperial Hotel on College Street in Killarney. So she is the last person shot who dies after the truce. An interesting thing there is that the official Dublin Castle report initially claimed that the IRA had killed Carey in their attempt to kill the British soldiers earlier, but the British military inquest ruled that she had, in fact, been at the hotel entrance, that there had been no shooting when she was shot by the RIC, supposedly accidentally. And just to mention one or two other women who were killed at the time, I mentioned Margaret Keogh. She's the only coming to man woman. As Eve said, again, the propaganda isn't always on one side. The original story was put out that she had been killed on the eve of the truce by a British murder gang. In fact, she was shot accidentally while hiding ammunition. You had two other women killed very quickly. Mary McConway, who was a young girl in Belfast, shot dead by machine gun fire from a special constabulary armoured car. And then you have Bridget Dillon, a 15-year-old girl in Tipperary. The IRA attempted to raid her house to take out her brothers and execute them as spies. But when they fired into the house, they shot dead Bridget Dillon. But the very last person, as I said, to reiterate, who was killed before the truce, Hannah Carey, who was shot at 11:50 a.m. with the truce coming into effect at 12 noon.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, guys. So I'd like to thank our panel today, John Dorney, David McCullough, Eve Morrison, Padraig O'Rourke. Our next head school will be on Kilkenny in the Revolutionary Decade, and that will be posted on the 23rd of July. So I hope you can join us for that, listeners. Thank you very much.